Hello, I'm Joseph Earp.
I'm Dan Dixon.
And this is the Brad Pitt Cast.
The podcast about Brad Pitt.
About Brad Pitt.
Exclusively.
Only Brad Pitt. Who is someone we both just adore, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose we are friends who spent a lot of our time talking about Brad Pitt.
Mm-hmm. So it was an early moment of like, you had me around for dinner and we were talking about something. I think we were talking about the assassination of Jesse James.
Yeah, which I actually still haven't seen, although this podcast should rectify that.
Yeah, in about a year's time. If we do a Brad Pitt film every year, which we're planning to.
Every week. Every year.
Every year.
A real project.
In the rest of our lives, we boyhood on tranquilizers. Yeah, and I remember we were talking about assassination, and I said, when is he ever bad?
Mm.
And you were like, I'm really glad that you said that, because I feel this way too.
Yeah, he's just always, no matter the film that I have seen him in, there's always something extraordinary about seeing Brad Pitt on screen.
Exactly.
Even if it's terrible. His presence is a balm.
Which I think is why the idea of doing this as a podcast became so appealing, was because Pitt is also, he makes choices. He makes choices in the films that he decides he's going to do, and he makes choices on screen. I think there's something almost, like, obviously he's better respected than someone like Nicolas Cage.
Mm.
But in the way that Nicolas Cage is like, you know that you're looking at Nicolas Cage. There's an element of construction, I think, in that you see the performer making choices.
You also know because of that there will be something interesting about a Nicolas Cage film, even if it's that, not that I've seen it, but the film he made about the Revelations, right? Or the Apocalypse, didn't he? Wasn't there a plane moving?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that was a piece of shit. But, you know, yeah, precisely. That I've always said, because, like, I'm someone who watches a lot of exploitation and horror cinema and cinema that gets derided as being bad. And I think what I find when I'm seeing a very bad performer or a very good performer is in both cases, I'm just always seeing a human being.
Mm.
You're always seeing a human being make some kind of choice. And if those choices are very good, then you're seeing the human being, and if they're very bad, you see the human being.
There was an extraordinary moment in an interview that Pitt did on his most recent press tour, I think, which we talked about, where he talks about how he gets frustrated at people thinking that acting is pretending, that you're kind of faking it, and he talks about when you see that emotion on screen, you're finding the emotion, which I found very moving.
Yeah,
it's quite touching. And in the most recent Pitt film we watched, I was thinking about that the whole time. And there is this sense of kind of authenticity that is quite endearing and moving. Absolutely. In Pitt.
And what is that film that we most recently watched that we're talking about this very day?
So this is what we're going to do. We're going to start out by talking about Ad Astra, starring Bradley Pitt.
Mm-hmm.
Pitt's most recent film, currently at the cinemas. And then we will, in future versions of this podcast, in future episodes, go back to the beginning and see how this particular iteration of Brad Pitt came to be. But yeah, today we're dedicating this podcast to Ad Astra.
Which I think is, we had been talking, we're going to talk about Brad Pitt, we'll do his whole career, and our initial plan was to start at his very first film and then move forward, which we'll still do eventually. But Ad Astra feels like, not a pivot, it doesn't feel like something's changing. It does feel like a reflection, because how is Ad Astra being marketed? It's Brad Pitt's face.
Yeah.
It's like, this is a leading man. He is Ad Astra, I think.
It's Brad Astra, which is not an original joke.
But a good one.
But it's hard to avoid.
I've also heard Dad Astra, Sad Astra.
All themes of Ad Astra.
Maybe spoilers for my opinion on the film, but also Bad Astra, which I think is increasingly how I feel about the film. But maybe we should we give a log line to Ad Astra broadly?
Yeah, so what happens in this movie? Brad Pitt is an astronaut.
Mm-hmm.
His father has gone missing, was sent off on a mission, a significant mission to the far reaches of the solar system long ago in the film. And it turns out that the top echelons of Space Command seem to suspect that Brad Pitt's father is doing something that may lead to the end of the solar system.
And is still alive, crucially.
And whereas his disappearance, he'd been kind of given up for dead, at least by Brad Pitt.
Mm-hmm.
But when this information is revealed, Brad Pitt is sent out into the solar system to send a message to his father and try to prevent him from destroying it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the arc of the film, traces Pitt's journey towards his father. I mean, it's very explicitly Freudian in its just a grand scale of son-father relationship.
Absolutely.
against the background of space.
It does. So it was written and directed by James Gray, who's a filmmaker who's been around for a long time, despite having made very few films. He's been around from the 90s. And, like, Gray is always obsessed with familial relationships. Hmm. There's a really great New Yorker profile on Gray recently that talks a lot about his mother's death from brain cancer. And I think it's interesting, in Ad Astra, there's a reference to the fact that Brad Pitt's mother died shortly after the father walked out.
There really is something in this film about women specifically being used to facilitate men's emotional journeys and almost for nothing else.
Oh, what a conversation that will be when we get to the end of this fucking film. But yeah, I think the difference that's happened to Gray over the course of his career is he started off making family dramas that were, like, he made a film called Two Lovers with Joaquin Phoenix, which is very much about family and love and relationship. And with this film, Ad Astra, and with Gray's last film, The Lost City of Z, they're also films about family, but they're thrown out onto an epic scale. I mean, the scale of this film basically ends in its last 15 minutes on a metaphor, the biggest metaphor for letting go of the pain that your father's caused you. Like, it's so explicit, and it's also so large scale. And that's, I think, the purpose of this film.
The film very much seems to be working towards its final metaphor, I think.
Which is...
Yeah.
Maybe we should start at the beginning. Yeah.
So how does this film open?
How does it act? Oh, it opens with text.
Yeah.
Which is... was really exciting to me, actually. When it opens on very, like, Blade Runner, the world is fucked, basically.
Yeah.
We're going to the far reaches of the galaxy in order to find... To the stars. Which is what Ad Astra is translated to. In a time of hope and conflict.
Yeah, which is... It's notable, I think, that this film takes this... What seems maybe to be a broad... kind of view of it does have some political commentary throughout it, like this broad view of the nature of the world, the nature of space travel, these big existential questions, but never really cashes them out in any significant way. So it's more curious about the father-son relationship. It kind of gets trapped in that. I think there's this interesting dynamic between the general and the particular.
I think it's not particularly interested specifically about anything. Maybe I should put my criticisms on the table.
Yeah. Joe did not like the film. At the end of the film, Joe turned to me
and it was so clear angry.
He did not like it.
I was very excited for this film. I'm a big Pitt fan. I'm a big James Gray fan. Everything I had seen about the film, I'm a big sci-fi fan.
Yeah.
I was really ready. And a lot of critics who I really admire had said the film was a masterpiece. I feel like a rare dissenting voice, I suppose. And so I was really frustrated. And my initial frustration was I wrote when I came out of the film, I was like, in the first two-thirds of that film, James Gray makes every right choice. In the last third, he makes every wrong choice. But I was so irritated by the ending of the film that when I have been reflecting on it on the last few days, I've realized that actually the problems start early.
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't agree entirely. I think I understand where you're coming from. I think I'm more sympathetic to the film. I think it's looking back, I think it's a mess. The film is definitely a mess. I think it has a number of really beautiful elements and I think perhaps the distinction between your and my perspective is I feel like I would recommend this to people and I feel like you wouldn't.
Absolutely would not. And I think, and this is why I guess it's helpful to lay out my criticisms early, because I only really have two. I think this is a ridiculous film, which is fine.
That's definitely true.
I spend my life watching ridiculous films, like Chopping Mall is one of my favorite great films. For instance. Films. Yeah, robots, cleaning robots kill people trapped in a mall. Perfect. Fantastic. The problem with this film is it's a ridiculous film.
It's no Chopping Mall.
No, it's no. It's 100% not Chopping. I wish. The problem with this film, I think, is that it's so ridiculous, but so convinced it's not ridiculous. It takes itself so seriously. It's self-serious,
yeah. And I think there's no greater crime in art than self-seriousness.
Completely humorless.
Which is interesting because it makes so many silly decisions. Yeah. And it's also interesting, so Joe has this thing he refers to as the werewolf test, which is that if you watch a film and... you are wondering about its quality, you can ask the question, would it be improved by the inclusion of a werewolf wreaking some havoc? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the strange things about this film is it almost does include a werewolf wreaking 100%. Some havoc. There kind of is a werewolf scene.
100%.
And yet,
It's a fucking... Well, so that's the thing, right? It can't handle its control. It thinks that it's very serious. It's not at all serious. And I think the second big criticism I have is that it thinks it's making very specific comments on a very epic scale. I think it's so vague.
Yeah.
So this is something that you brought up. It's why, yeah, I was like, let's bring it up early. Like, the film is at one point later in the film, spoiler alert, by the way, for the entirety of
We'll be ruining Ad Astra.
Which is a good thing. You want it. when Brad Pitt encounters his father, played by Tommy Lee Jones.
Which you also know will happen. Like, there's no point in the film where you think maybe we're not going to see Tommy Lee Jones on screen.
No, absolutely. We have to see Tommy Lee Jones. I guess they could do the Solaris thing of Jones being a ghost.
Yeah.
But he's not.
He's a real life Tommy Lee Jones.
Flesh and blood, real deal Tommy Lee Jones. He says to Tommy Lee Jones at one point, "We're all that we have," referring to the human race. So that, you hear it, you're like, oh, wow, that's a political point.
Yeah, as in Tommy Lee Jones is searching for aliens. We're not going to find the aliens. It's just us.
It's just humans. Nowhere in the film is that thesis ever explored again.
No.
What's the film's thesis about the current political landscape or the current environmental landscape?
It doesn't love consumption. It thinks that we're going to keep warring over resources. It is vague. So. I think it does raise those issues, but not in any substantial way. And also... I mean, at some point we should start talking about the plot, but it's probably worth saying Brad Pitt is in every single scene in this film, which makes it a wonderful inauguration of the Brad Pitt cast. But I think because Brad Pitt is in every single scene and is just a totally apolitical character, you kind of have a bunch of different movies going on around him, but you just keep following him. And there are probably a bunch of more interesting movies going on around him.
Well, maybe we'll get to it. I think there's one... moment where something happens in the film and I'm like, this should be the whole film.
Let's begin.
So Pitt is a
opening on earth literally.
Pitt is a decorated astronaut. His father
Roy McBride. I think we'll refer to him as Brad Pitt throughout the podcast,
yeah,
in his various incarnations.
He's Roy McBride. His father was very decorated. He's a famously stoic, which I think is an interesting thing. Yeah,
his heartbeat, we are told, does not go above 80.
Yeah, and there's a big focus in this film that he's constantly being monitored. His emotions are constantly being monitored.
Yeah.
Which I think is why you cast Brad Pitt in this movie, right? Talking about Pitt's history, what is Pitt very good at? He's something of a... overactor is not right. He's baroque, I think. Mm. He's like ornamental as an actor.
Wonderful, yeah.
It's why you love to see Brad Pitt eating things. Things that he can do that take multiple steps that he can spread out and kind of show off.
He's indulgent in his movements.
Absolutely.
But not showy, which I think is an interesting balance.
Because he has this shit-eating quality.
Definitely. Oh, the grin. Yeah.
Absolutely. Like a humility tied with this great kind of over-the-topness.
And also essential is that the audience... I mean, this film is pitched as a Brad Pitt film. Obviously, we are there to see Brad Pitt, not just us, although us especially, perhaps. And the audience, he's recognised on screen as astronaut Roy McBride. We recognise him off-screen as Brad Pitt. He's notoriously stoic, as is Brad Pitt on screen throughout our, you know, various relationships with him.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important, is that we know this man.
Exactly. And I think it's also... the masterstroke of the film and the masterstroke of Brad Pitt's casting for me feels like you take someone like Brad Pitt, who's ornamental, who is big, and you tell him to do almost nothing. There's Brad Pitt does so little in this film. It's entirely in his face, and he's often, I think, increasingly over the last like 6 years, he's increasingly silent in his films, but in this he's also like facially silent.
He's space-suited often as well. Exactly. So bodily silent.
Yeah, exactly. He's kind of neutered. And I think what's the significance thing about the character, about Roy, is he has this voiceover, which is proving to be quite a controversial element of the film.
Yeah, it's bad.
When I was initially on the side of the film for the first 20, 30 minutes, I thought, I get the voiceover. Because the point of the voiceover and the point of the character is he's not calm at all, despite constantly being calm.
That's true.
He hates things and he hates his life and he hates fucking space. He's so sick of space.
He doesn't like it.
And he's suppressed it completely to the point where there's moments in the voiceover where he's saying things like, I'm angry, and it's completely neutered.
Yeah, which is, I guess, yeah, okay, that's a selling point. I still feel like you can get that from Brad Pitt's face. I feel like I have 100%. The confidence in Brad Pitt's face to convey those things. 100%. I mean, so the first time we see him, he's on this space antenna, right? Mm-hmm. And he is doing what Brad Pitt does, which is stuff with his hands. He's kind of working like a kind of mechanically on the antenna in some capacity. Mm-hmm. And then there is a what proves to be a theme, an important theme throughout the film. Some kind of power surge occurs, and a section of the space antenna to which Brad Pitt is adjacent starts to collapse. He talks to home base in some capacity, raises the alarm, pulls a lever, which for some reason is a This is something that happens a lot in this film, is there are kind of manual levers for significant overrides or whatever that you would think there would be other ways in the what is called the near future, we are told. This is the near future. You think there'd be other ways of handling them as opposed to having to have Brad Pitt scramble across a space antenna to pull a lever with his strength of will.
So, like, because, like, of course, who the fuck cares if Brad Pitt has to pull a lever? But when the whole point of the film... And it translates into the rest of the scene, which is Pitt parachutes. He's flying off.
So, as the antenna explodes, Pitt falls, is calm in his communication. We're in a fairly hectic situation. Is calm saying that, okay, I've got to, you know, stepping whoever he's talking to on the other end of the radio through his actions. Has some trouble launching his parachute. Launches the parachute. Some debris. Gets pierced by debris from the space antenna. So we're kind of given this scene to set up Brad Pitt calm under pressure.
But also, sorry, that was Ida the dog, greyhound.
We're accompanied by for this podcast.
Sitting on the couch staring at me. Ridiculous. Ridiculous. He's like corkscrewing through space, like flipping hand over.
He writes himself.
You just pass out.
He gives some excuse for not passing out. He says something like, I'm trying to minimize rotation in order not to black out. So again, this is a silly film. I think this is important.
Absolutely.
It starts off being silly.
Absolutely. From the get-go. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, obviously the debris, of course it wouldn't, you know. But for me, in that scene, I was like, don't introduce the debris piercing his parachute at all. Because it just makes me think, why isn't there a lot more debris?
Yeah.
And again, quibbles, right? But the film... And then he just, like, picks himself up.
Yeah, he lands. It's not even... You'd think there's... I really was under the impression, like, oh, okay, Brad Pitt's going to be seriously injured. And this is going to be, at least for the first part of the film, recovery. He's totally fine.
The next scene is him seeing the captains and then being, like, they're kind of the heads of SpaceCom, they're called in the film, who are like... You're right. And he's like, yeah, I'm all right.
Which, yeah, no, he does. No, and it's a Marvel scene. The opening scene could just be in a Marvel movie.
Absolutely. It's so bizarre.
Yeah.
But then...
So he, yeah.
Then the it feels to me like the film writes itself.
Like Brad Pitt in the air flying down from the space antenna.
To save the world. I think as I say, I'm a fan of Grey. It's an anomaly that I don't like one of his films. And what I think Grey is fantastic about is very quiet intensity, which the film then slips into after that very overblown scene of Brad Pitt falling off the antenna. There's then, for about maybe half an hour, just scenes of people in rooms talking quietly and solemnly about very intense things. So you get this sense of... The Lost City of Z, that's how the film is almost all the way through. You get this real sense of mounting trouble and pressure, but everyone in it feels kind of stoned to how serious and bad things are.
Yeah. That's definitely a... I mean, I haven't seen Lost City of Z, but there's a sense of calm before the literal storm in this.
Yeah, the world's falling apart.
Yeah, and then it's kind of a people in rooms somberly or stoically or quietly, worriedly discussing how we might save the world.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, and the rooms are interesting, and the actors are interesting.
And so it's well shot. It's, you know...
So we have Brad Pitt in this, like, meeting these SpaceCom commanders, essentially the equivalent of Trump's Space Force, as far as I can tell, the military wing of NASA or whatever. And they tell him, you think your father's dead. In fact, your father may have just caused the surge, which obliterated your space antenna. We want you to go to Mars and send him a message. That's the basic, that's the kind of nuts and bolts of the scene, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is significant how I mean, we mentioned before that this whole thing is a metaphor, right? But the, yeah, like, the idea that your dad is doing something that is literally causing ripples through your life, that,
yeah,
exploding your life, yes, like, it's the most heavy-handed metaphor.
Yeah.
And then Pitt is introduced to Donald Sutherland,
who is very old.
He's and so old.
It's very strange. Donald Sutherland is maybe a Colonel Pruitt, I think his name might be. I think he's a colonel. So he was a... He knew Brad Pitt's father. So Brad Pitt's father was specifically on this project called the Lima Project. The reason he's in the far reaches of space was to find alien life. Colonel Pruitt had some association with him. Brad Pitt asks about the last conversation they had. It was some fight.
Yeah.
So there's bad blood, we find. None of this is paid off in any really significant capacity.
Because I understand Gray probably just... I mean, Gray is a classicist, right? He, like, yeah, the films he idolizes are films from the 70s. Sutherland is a classic actor, sure, in a lot of ways. Sutherland is exactly the leading man that Brad Pitt has, like, fought against being in, like, very capable, very level-headed leading man. And, yeah, Pruitt is presumably... Well, at the beginning, my assumption was that Pruitt was going to be an insidious force because we quite quickly learn that, like, we should be distrustful of Spacecom. We should be distrustful of everything they're telling Brad Pitt about.
Seemingly through Brad Pitt's voiceover. Yeah. Like, as he's walking out of the room, you hear him saying, as if I even had a choice whether to say yes or no to this mission, I have to go and find my dad or send the message to my dad.
Yeah.
He's specifically being sent to Mars to send his dad an audio message. It seems like there would be other ways of handling this.
It's mad.
But that's the kind of MacGuffin, at least. And yeah, Colonel Pruitt is to be his escort. And so you have this sense of like, oh, he's the insidious arm of Spacecom who will...
Yeah, but Pruitt isn't an antagonist. He's also not a protagonist because what happens is Pruitt and Pitt go to the moon on a commercial
flight. Literally a Virgin Galactic flight, which I must have been sponsored, right? Richard Branson must have thrown some cash at them.
They can't have used the name otherwise. But...
And there's this weird element. So in this flight, so Brad Pitt, it's like no one can know that you're... Like, this is all top secret. We're going to send you on a commercial flight so no one finds out. And there's this weird, like, parody of air travel where
Pitt
asks for a hot towel...
They're floating through the... I kind of liked that.
Yeah, I did too. I mean, at this point, I'm basically on board with the film, I should say as well. At this point, in watching the film, throughout the whole film, I'm having a fine time.
Yeah.
I'm doing okay. But yeah, it's funny. I think it would have just been nice if the film either leaned into the funniness a bit more or used it to wrap into its central themes a bit more.
Well, because that's the thing, right? Like, I'm enjoying the vision of commercial spacecraft. It's incredibly, like, precisely realized.
Yeah.
It really... It feels believable. I felt... We saw this in a packed cinema, and I sensed everyone's attention really, like, getting precise in that scene. But then Brad Pitt lands on the moon, gets off the spacecraft, and...
There's a subway on the moon.
And there's just some voiceover that's like, oh, you know, we're chasing the problems on Earth, we're expanding them onto the moon. No!
Yeah, the things we're running away from on Earth, we're just replicating here. Which is, I guess... I think that was definitely a moment where I was like, well, what is this voiceover doing? It feels like it has been forced on... It felt like the you know, Blade Runner voiceover being forced on them by the studio, because... Everything that is being said is on screen, basically. Like, even throughout kind of Brad Pitt's... Again, Brad Pitt's face conveys it if he's, like, talking about his concern about something or his fears or his anxieties. Or in this circumstance, it's like, yeah, we know that commercialism on the moon, obviously you're making a comment about that. It's not...
But I got a sense of, like... Yeah, of course, like, you know, it's... I don't need a director to necessarily spell out to me what that's saying.
Yeah.
As, you know... I just guess, I suppose, is this an anti-capitalist film? Because
it's entirely on board with commercial space travel.
Yeah.
Which is...
But also, like, what's being proposed? Or not even what's being proposed, what's being criticised? I guess because the film wants to say, which is something that, like, as a diehard socialist, I agree with. The film says something like, there's something about human nature that is drawn to capitalism. There is something about capitalism that will always destroy the Earth.
Yeah.
Like, capitalism is a necessarily destructive force. But
there's nothing in Brad Pitt's actions that has anything to do with that, and I think that's the problem. You have his voiceover commenting on these things, but he never does anything that resists any of those systems.
And then also at the end of the film's thesis doesn't turn out to be there's something natural about human beings that is attracted to capitalism. It's human beings can be good. But why? Because Brad Pitt, like, farted around in space with Tommy Lee Jones. Like, I'm not convinced of anything.
No. In terms of a hero's journey, there's no real trans... There's no necessary transformation along the way. There's no moment... I mean, obviously, there are significant moments for Brad Pitt, but he doesn't seem to change as a person substantially because of them.
The film wants to pretend that he's changed drastically at the end of the film.
Yeah. But I don't see why.
I don't see why. I don't... Or how, even.
Yeah. So... There is a... Look, I do want to emphasize that this... When we arrive at the moon, the film starts to become quite beautiful. I genuinely do think. I think there are a lot of very striking visual sequences and things which I had, like, never seen before in any other form and was kind of overwhelmed by, especially what happens when they leave the moon base. So they all... For some... Again, there's a lot of having to move between places for various reasons for the sake of the film that aren't really explained, but it's just like, well, we got to have more scenes. But... After they arrive at the space station on the moon, they are given a kind of freelance military escort, kind of mercenary escort,
mm-hmm.
and they get into space buggies. Brad Pitt and Donald Sutherland mount up on this space buggy and are escorted to another moon base from where they will go to Mars, I think.
Yeah.
And so this, what happens here, a sequence that is used for the posters and kind of make, if you were to think this was a central element to the film, you would think it was a very different film to the film it actually is.
Yeah. But there is lying to you.
There's a space buggy shootout.
Yeah.
Which I really liked.
I liked the space
buggy. A lot. I loved how it was shot. There's gorgeous, like, wide, slow shots of pirate space buggies approaching the...
And you never really see... The pirate space buggies are always shot in wide. There's no... sense of who they are.
Yeah, or what they're not humanized at all.
No.
But that works really well, I think.
I think so. I think this is more of what I wanted the film to be, which is you don't have to make a big deal about the fact that you're having a moon buggy shootout on the moon, because that by itself is like, is clearly ridiculous.
Yeah.
And in fact, you can play it very straight-faced and it works.
Yeah, and it also doesn't really matter that it doesn't have any... There's no real narrative transformation as a result of it.
No.
It doesn't build towards anything.
It's not making a point.
But it's cool.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
I think it's broadly true that more films need to settle with being cool.
Yeah.
I think particularly, and this is such a ham-fisted political point, but I think particularly post-Trump, there has been a...
Self-seriousness.
Scramble. Yeah, a scramble to make films about... they have to be about something. I'm perfectly fine with... seeing a moon buggy fight on the moon and being like, I was transported.
Definitely.
I was uplifted by that scene.
And Brad Pitt's in it, right? To bring it back to the topic of this podcast, a huge part of what makes that scene cool is that Brad Pitt specifically is engaged in a moon buggy shootout, and of course I want to see that.
Yeah.
And notably, he's restricted in this scene. Like, he's stuck on a moon buggy. He doesn't have a weapon initially. He has to get one off a body. So it's, as you said earlier, all the work is being done with his face.
Yeah.
And... there's this sense of exploring new regions of Brad Pitt in a way in this scene, because you're getting to see him in this new situation, extremely restricted, doing interesting and like super engaging things. His because you know he's calm under pressure, and yet he's clearly in a very fraught situation. All these things are going on, and it's exciting.
Yeah.
I would at least recommend people seek it out for that sequence.
Yeah, I guess so. It's also I think worth pointing out at this stage that everyone's made the comparison, but it's because it's right there on the screen. The film is basically Apocalypse Now.
Sure.
It's a military, quasi-military person being sent into uncharted territory to silence or control someone who's gone completely mad, has been driven mad by nature.
In a kind of understandable way, in a way that represents various existential crises of humanity.
Absolutely. And I'm fine with Apocalypse Now in space, but what makes Apocalypse Now... great, I suppose, is for me, it better walks the line between self-seriousness and ridiculousness.
Oh, yeah, it's got a lot of genuinely funny moments.
And it's Apocalypse Now makes its points by being absurd. What's special about that?
It's cartoonish.
Yeah, exactly, because it's talking about a cartoonish, crazy war.
Yeah.
Whereas this film is talking about, I don't know, humans sometimes being bad, but also ultimately being good.
If they're Brad Pitt.
If they're Brad Pitt. So anyway, and then this is... I'm going to try and tone down on what feels like nitpicking, but this is the thing that drives me crazy, right? As the moon buggy fight is over, there's a voice coming over saying to the Sutherland character, Pruitt,
irregular saying, heartbeat.
Like, do you have an irregular heart? Yes, of course he hasn't. He looks he's fucking 97. 80. Yeah. Exactly. What the hell is this man doing on the moon?
Well, yeah, was there no one else that could escort Brad Pitt?
I suppose James Gray wants to work with Donald Sutherland. I can think of no other explanation. I guess because he'd have to know Tommy Lee Jones, but why does he have to know
And also, there are people, it turns out, who are connected to Tommy Lee Jones who are not that old later on in the... And Tommy Lee Jones seemed to be...
He seems old when you first...
Because you see videos of him early on in the Lima Project, and he's not... It's Tommy Lee Jones. He's not a young man ever.
No. It's astonishingly bizarre. And Donald Sutherland's like, I have to go to the hospital, presumably to die. Like, what the fuck are you... I guess the broad idea is that Sutherland's dying wish is to heal the connection, the kind of broken relationship with Tommy
Lee Jones. But you don't get enough of Donald's character to know
why that is. You have no idea what their relationship is.
Yeah.
It's
not... There are no stakes in their relationship apart from the stakes again that we know that Tommy Lee Jones is going to destroy the world.
There's no stakes in anything, which I guess is why we should also briefly bring up, because I think this is the relationship with the least stakes. Throughout, Liv Tyler plays plays Brad Pitt's estranged wife.
I literally cannot remember a single line of hers in the film.
Brad Pitt watches video logs that he's left him. The only sentiment I remember her expressing is she says something like,
"There's like a you don't spend enough time."
There's a you don't spend enough time vibe, and she says something like, "I'm sorry that I'm sending this as a voicemail message and not talking to you." Oh, so you get a sense that there's a gulf between them. But that's all we have to say on that until the ending, because there's no more of that until the ending.
Liv Tyler, as you kind of see some memories of her throughout. So this is a weird trope of the film. Again, it's never quite delivered on, but you get these flashbacks that Brad Pitt experiences of his childhood with his father.
Yeah.
I liked how it was shot.
I think it's an astonishing... There are sequences where you cut between home movie footage of young Brad Pitt and space. And that's the thesis. That's what the film is thrusting towards, personal and the epic.
Also, not to end up too much on your side, but why does Brad Pitt actually want to go to space?
Why does anybody in this film want to do anything?
Yeah, but so Liv Tyler, you see these flashbacks of Liv Tyler and you get this sense that Brad Pitt could never really learn to love. Is this sense, or he could never have a nourishing relationship in which he loved someone as they could love him or something. So you get, and he's obviously, despite, and Joe, you mentioned earlier the kind of psychological testing that Brad Pitt undergoes throughout the film, he like sticks a little sticker on his neck and talks to a machine, and that's how it's always done. So it's like this little machine psychotherapist who says, you know, how you doing, and he tells him how he's doing, and then the machine says, you're okay,
leads to the only moment of humor in the film, which must be on purpose.
It is, yes.
There's a point where he's being interviewed by the machine and he goes off. He's like, I hate this, I'm sick of this. And the machine is like, okay,
you've passed your test.
You've cleared.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Sutherland fucks off and dies, I guess. And then.
Wait. So, no, not quite. So, it's when they arrive at the moon base, Sutherland says, he gives him a USB that looks like it's made out of mulch.
Cardboard.
Yeah, and he's like breathing heavily and clearly losing it, and Brad Pitt is shocked that this octogenarian is dying after experiencing an extremely traumatic moon buggy chase in which everyone except Brad Pitt and Donald Sutherland were shot or blown up or crashed. And he says, Spacecom doesn't want you to have this, but here it is.
Which is a reoccurring problem in the film, right, is that Spacecom are an insidious, insidious, but also massive and
bureaucracy, right?
Bureaucracy that continually let Brad Pitt get into direct contact with people who would have reason for disrupting the mission.
Yeah.
It happens twice in the film. If Donald Sutherland has a history with Tommy Lee Jones, we later find out that Spacecom are basically going to be like, if you can't get Tommy Lee Jones to come back, blow him the fuck up immediately.
So, in terms of Spacecom's motivations, why are they even sending Brad Pitt there in the first place?
Which leads to And yeah, why are they singing Brad Pitt? Also, it seems really fucking easy to find Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, he's
no
on
point
Neptune.
In this film. You would imagine, what's this film about? It's about finding your dad. There's no difficulty in finding him. They know almost precisely where
they
he
are
is.
Able to send a rocket directly to him with no confusion. Maybe actually, okay, this is not made clear by the film, but it just occurred to me. We can get to this in a moment, but Brad Pitt does at some point send a message to Tommy Lee Jones. Tommy Lee Jones sends a message back. That seems to be when they find out where he is. So I guess that's what they need, is to
true.
Get him to send a return message. Although,
true.
Tommy Lee Jones sending a message back is not within character of anything else he does in the film. No. That actually doesn't work with how.
Why would he believe that
it
there
eventuates.
Would be. Why, he doesn't know his son. How does he know that Brad Pitt is his son?
Yeah, I mean, especially.
It could be
like,
anyone.
We could, right now in 2019, before what is labeled as the near future, we have the technology to recreate voices. I'm sure Spacecom has that technology.
100%. He doesn't know what his son's
sounds
adult
like
voice
in,
sounds
yeah,
like.
Yeah, 20 years or whatever. Fucking. Okay, anyway, look.
Well,
we're
getting
on the moon.
We're getting to the best part of the film, so I'll be
yeah,
nice about the
definitely.
Film for about
a genuinely transcendent moment.
Yeah, 100%, which is that Pitt joins up with another space crew.
So there's four other astronauts on board, I think. Yeah, four.
Yeah, and he's joining up with them. And
to get to Mars, which is the only place left since all the electrical surges happened, that they like the only base from which they can send a message to Neptune.
Yeah, absolutely.
For some reason.
For some reason. That kind of thing I'm not too... That's fine. I know that the film has to go a long way and it has to be hard.
Yeah.
I'm not necessarily have a problem with
that. That stuff could be fine in a different film.
Absolutely. And then they receive a message saying a distress signal, and Pitt is like, we have to keep going. And the captain...
From a nearby ship.
Yeah. And then the captain, in a completely pointless exchange, is like, no.
We're obliged.
We're obliged.
Which, yeah.
What?
I mean, okay, so maybe, and this is a bit of a stretch, but if this film has something to say about politics, I think they say the ship is like Norwegian from some Scandinavian country. There might be something to be said about space, like, as a place of potential collaboration between nations, something like that. There's an obligation to
help.
Although that's true. It's true on the, like, ocean. I mean, look, I'm not a seaman, but as I understand, I think it's true, right? That if a naval ship... Here's a distress signal. They're obliged to. I don't know.
Well, it's Alien, right? That's what happens in Alien. Ridley Scott's Alien is they answer a distress signal, and there's back and forth about that, about money.
Well, Brad should have learnt.
Yeah, he should have fucking watched Alien. Fantastic film. And this is explicitly Alien. This part. They follow a distress signal. They go into an abandoned pit, and the captain of the ship that he's on. So two people.
We get a sense that one of the crew of the ship that Pitt is on is too nervous to go aboard.
Yeah. Which leads to
nothing. Or it leads to something,
nothing.
But that doesn't matter.
No.
And so Pitt, captain, go aboard in quite a beautiful sequence. They float across to this distressed ship. They force entry. And then there are, like, camera slowly following them through a corridor. And then they get separated.
Mm-hmm.
And Brad Pitt, they were communicating via, the little intercom in their helmet. And then Brad Pitt loses contact with the captain. And he's, starts to, again, in an example of the calmest man in the world, getting quite agitated. Brad Pitt obviously starts to worry about where the captain is. And then there's this extraordinary shot where you see the captain spacesuit from behind, Brad Pitt looking at him. And it looks like he's having... He looks like he's having a seizure. At first I thought, oh, he's caught in an electrical.
Yeah.
Caught in a surge.
Yeah. It's an extraordinary, and it's a moment of, as you say, it's the werewolf moment, right? It's a perfect moment that Pitt goes up and in just this complete tonal 180. It's worth noting everything prior in the film has been slow and self-serious.
Nothing in the film suggests that this will happen.
Nothing in the film suggests that what is happening to this man is...
We are told...
Go on.
That the ship went with a distress signal... That it's a experimental animal laboratory.
Yeah. Oh, do we hear?
Yeah,
that?
That's what the ship is labeled. The ship is labeled as that. I still didn't expect this
because it was more of a surprise. That would have been slightly less of a surprise thing because the dude is being killed by a monkey.
So the monkey,
monkey,
a space monkey, which, as far as we know, is the only organism on the ship.
Well,
we don't see any.
Pitt shoots one space monkey.
I thought it was
laser.
The same monkey coming back.
Okay. We're vague on the exact space monkeys.
But initial shot is, so you have the camera right behind the captain's helmet, and the monkey's face emerges slowly. And I was certain it was an alien at first.
Brianna, my partner, who we saw the film with, thought throughout, it was only afterwards that we talked about it, she thought it was some kind of like alien space monkey.
Okay, yeah.
I just think that's because it's pure CGI. It looks a tiny bit dodgy.
It does. It's fine. And also, this is a film about finding intelligent life beyond Earth. Absolutely. So you think, oh, is this going to become an alien film? It does not.
Astonishing.
But then, like, within moments, I was aware, like, as the entire face emerges, I'm aware it's a monkey. The monkey shrieks and zeroes in on Brad Pitt.
Incredible. I'm laughing out of joy for how great it is. Because this is what I mean. This is my... Feels like this is an illustration of what I think of problems with the rest of the film. Ridiculous. Space monkey? Ridiculous. But also feeds into the themes of the film, which is this idea that there's something about nature, life, that goes mad when isolated and separated from communities.
Definitely.
And so you have this fucking bonkers set piece with a killer monkey that also perfectly ties into the film's strongest thesis, which is like, we are stronger together. This monkey's been separated. It's gone mad. I wish the whole... But I don't wish the whole film, because the other thing to say about what I think the sequence is great is the monkey is killed. The rest of the film is bizarre. It's never as bizarre as Killer Space Monkey. So there's a sense in which it's this brief flurry of another film just gets teleported in.
Yeah, which might be the middle of the film, maybe almost precisely.
Because the Tommy Lee Jones thing goes on for a long time.
Yeah.
But extraordinary. Extraordinary. I can't wait till the film is out properly. So, because if anyone spoils Space Monkey for someone else, that's a genuine crime for which fines should be handed down. Because
I think so.
Such a pleasure.
I was hoping it would signal a more radical twist, which I assume you were as well. Not necessarily like space monkeys have destroyed Donald Sutherland and are like sending searches back to Earth.
Tommy Lee Jones is a space monkey.
Oh, Tommy Lee Jones. That's right. Yeah. That would be something. It would be a more interesting film than it is. But I was thinking we would be getting a new kind of film. But it actually takes a radical shift in the opposite direction almost. It doubles down on its self-seriousness after this.
Absolutely. Which I do think I don't mind. I do like that being an island of madness. And when I look back fondly on the film, I think it works. That scene works because you're not expecting it, and because you kind of just, after it happens, it's like you're looking around the cinema being like, what the like, did I dream what just happened?
I mean, if I were to pen an apologia for this film, it would be about how we see Brad Pitt going through a series of variously insane situations and having to deal with them while being this calm, stoic guy who, you know, man reaches middle age, discovers he has inner life that he has to deal with, maybe through therapy, is like, that's not a particularly new take, but this is an interesting way of looking at that. And it's at times quite a beautiful way of thinking through that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's more beauty to come in the film. I think these are the reasons I would recommend it, right? Like, it has substance in that dynamic. I think it's extraordinarily silly, and I think it is not sufficiently aware of its silliness, and that is ultimately if there is a fatal flaw, that is it.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think there's value in that. I would recommend it to people for the monkey scene.
The monkey scene is one of the purest moments of joy I've had at the cinema in some time. And in a way, I think because I had so many mounting worries about the film, I was really like, oh, maybe this ship has been course corrected, like in a major way. With a monkey.
Yeah. But not to be.
Well, because then I'm still so uplifted by what happens after that that, I mean, Pitt has a nice moment of reflection about the captain's death where he says something like, you're breathing and then you're not breathing, which again is not particularly new, but it is a fairly precise, nicely drawn crack in who he is as a character.
Yeah.
That you do get a sense of like, oh, okay, this is taking a toll on him. And you don't see it on his face, but you certainly feel it.
Which I think, again, these are the kinds of scenes where it's essential that it's Brad Pitt, right?
Absolutely.
Like, we need to have known this man for much longer than the course of the film for this to work.
100%. 100%. And also, I think you need to have a character who so fully inhabits the role. There's such a sense of, like, you know, these people are the same.
Well, I think this might be, and perhaps we'll explore this in future episodes, but I think this might be one of the most compelling things about Brad Pitt, is he is somehow an actor who you never forget that he is Brad Pitt, and that does not matter.
100%.
And there are so few people who could do that.
100%. Which is why his best films are where he works with a director who knows that.
Yeah.
Like Tarantino in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which we'll talk about in two and a half years if we do a film a week. His character in that film has the history of Brad Pitt. It makes sense that it's Brad. Who else could play? I can't think of anyone else who could play that role in that way.
No. It's too...
It's tied up so much in so his tied legacy. Up in that. Which is why Oscar talk is kind of boring in some ways, but I really hope that Pitt wins an Oscar this year, because I think between Ad Astra, even if I think it's a film that I don't like, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it feels like there is a sense in which he's doing the thing that the Academy love, that he's reflecting on his legacy.
Yeah.
These are films tied into that.
Well, what's important seems to be that he is tired yet unhindered 100%. In these films. And I think that is something that is not, like, we know this of Brad Pitt through, like, profiles we have read on him and his experiences with paparazzi and celebrity through the years, as well as his history of kind of flirting with being a leading man or a character actor or whatever.
Yeah.
Those things are essential. And yeah, Once Upon a Time handles that extraordinarily well. And it's also, I mean, very different film, but it's funny, and it knows how to make Brad Pitt funny.
100%. It also ends with its own baboon moment, Once Upon a Time.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Which has been meditative and beautiful and sad, and then it goes, and the flamethrowers come out.
And again, which Brad Pitt's melancholy is essential too.
Yeah.
I think we could even call this podcast Brad Pitt's Melancholy. because that's such a, it's the Brad Pitt cast, and it will remain that, but that is such a, I mean, Ad Astra is, again, he's good at conveying that in Ad Astra. Unfortunately, the voiceover steps on it a bunch.
I think I'm also, it's worth saying, suckered by the voiceover, because an under-discussed quality of Pitt is what a fantastic voice he has.
He does have a great voice.
He just, it's so rich and so, it's like wood cracking, you know? It's it's great. And then
are landing on Mars after the monkey incident. Yeah. The crew are rattled because their captain has been murdered by a space monkey.
Sentence that just makes you go...
Yeah,
makes
I want to see that
when
film.
I hear it, I'm like, maybe this film is a masterpiece. It's not. Yeah, it's
unfortunately.
But that sentence elevates it.
And then you have the kind of... The nervous crew member who has been promoted to captain is landing the ship. It's caught by another power surge. The power surge is presumably coming from Tommy Lee Jones's Lima project, and so the ship gets kind of off center, and it looks like it might crash on Mars. Brad Pitt takes over from this anxious captain, because the new captain, because he's losing control of the ship, and he's so anxious that he can't press the buttons that he needs to press, I guess.
Yes,
and so
I don't know what the point of
they
this
land
is.
Brad Pitt says, due to Brad Pitt's new, they land, and Brad Pitt says, I won't tell Spacecom. But again, I mean, that crew does turn up again later in the film.
That promoted captain turns up later for no purpose.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I suppose I'm being ungenerous when I say I don't see the point. I do see the point. The point is Brad Pitt is becoming more and more anti-Spacecom, and he's seeing that everyone around him is being driven mad by space.
I wonder...
It's not fair to say.
I think
don't see the point.
This is just something I'm going to say because it came into my mind. Don't know if it's true or not. I wonder if this film, one of its central thematic conflicts and one of the reasons it doesn't work, is because it simultaneously has a socialist and a libertarian ideology. And Brad
like
Pitt
that.
Is operating...
I don't know what the fuck that means, but I like it.
Well, Brad Pitt is operating in a kind of libertarian universe in which it's the one man who can save everything. But it never actually pays off thematically the community is important theme, which is kind of suggested out throughout, but never actually delivered on in any substantial way.
Yeah.
So that seems to be like the meta theme is we need one another. We only have Earth. We must join together to, you know, ensure that Tommy Lee Jones doesn't blow us up with electrical surges. And yet one man is responsible for resolving
that's
that.
Very
and I think that is... A significant problem with this film.
I like that. I think that's an astute read of the film. Which I remember when I started to feel myself separating from the film, I was like, why am I not liking this film? And the first thing that came to my mind is like, because it's acting like it's not a movie and it is a movie. Like, it keeps doing these, like, completely tension...
I don't know what you mean.
Well, it keeps doing these, like, tension-breaking things that it does solely to propel the plot forward. Like Donald Sutherland.
Mm.
We're saying, why does he need to be here? All these things.
Yeah.
It's so he can propel the plot forward. But
as film, with the... In the final scene, the film's final, like, the nuclear blast Brad Pitt uses to propel him back towards her.
Sure.
It's
acting like it's above the worst tropes of Hollywood cinema while using them constantly.
Mm.
And it's about to do it in a way that I feel like... You know, lots of people love this film, and you always feel like a gremlin when you don't. And I suppose I should try and see the merit more. But what the film's about to do is when I completely...
Yeah, you leave home base.
100%. Because he meets a...
Well, so they land on Mars.
Yeah.
Mars is set up for, like... It seems like Mars, uniquely in this solar system... has a population, some of whom are just Martians who've never left Mars, including Natasha Lyonne in a scene that got a laugh from the audience we were watching it with, because hey, it's Natasha Lyonne from Russian Doll, and then she's a wonderful actress. She
filmed it before Russian Doll.
I suppose so.
So no one knew that she was going to be suddenly in the cultural consciousness again.
Yeah.
It's like Idris Elba being in the first Thor movie.
That's right.
Being playing no one. It happens all the time. You have major actors cast in minor roles who then get very famous. Mm. It's like going back and watching a Joanna Hogg film and seeing like Tom Hiddleston a character actor in this. Yeah.
So yeah, Brad Pitt gets signed into Mars by Natasha Lyonne, and this is the place where he goes into a... The aesthetic of the film changes totally at this point.
But becomes... This is when... You mentioned the film being beautiful before.
I think this is when it's most beautiful.
It's stunningly beautiful, this section. All of this stuff is so beautiful.
I also think it wants to be Stalker in this.
The Tarkovsky film.
Yeah, because it's... I mean, the way in which it shoots... Like, Mars has all these kind of big concrete rooms. It has spaces and corridors that don't seem to serve any purpose.
There's a shot which...
Everything's red, obviously.
There's the most stalkerish shot where Brad Pitt is walking in a corridor of light.
Yeah.
It's not even a physical corridor. No. There's just darkness, and there's a dog standing in front of him.
Which is literally the dog from Stalker. It's the German Shepherd. So there's this very direct reference...
You made a noise when we were watching the film, which is like one of my favourite things, that when I'm seeing a movie with someone and it happens, like an appreciation of like, a moment of like that. You know, Paul Schrader wrote a whole book about cinematic transcendence, and I think the book is fantastic and I love it, but I think it's as equally well represented just in people going like,
sure. There's no elaboration on that.
You just go... And it's an extraordinary shot.
It also, I feel like... I think I had... Looking back on the film... I think this film is worth it for those sequences. Mm-hmm. But I wish it had done something with them carrying through to the end of the film. I wish it had been thematically and aesthetically coherent in a way that it had taken the philosophy of the scenes on Mars forward.
Sure.
The end of Mars is very silly. But I guess... So Brad Pitt is in this recording studio that... Where he has this kind of...
It's great. Well,
60s microphone.
And I like this
too. I love this aesthetic.
It's Brad Pitt's recording the message for his dad.
Which has been written by Spacecom for him to read verbatim.
Yeah, and he does it and there's no response. And then he improvises his own...
Yeah, so I mean, if you feel like he's on Mars for a little while, he's doing the Spacecom response several times. There's no response from his dad.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
And then he kind of improvises this thing. And what I think is also another very smart move is that because he's in what is essentially like a recording studio through which the Spacecom people are standing like record producers.
Yes, there's three figures behind the glass.
Made me think of Her Smell, which is a great 2019 film where Elizabeth...
Wonderful studio scene.
Yeah, Elizabeth Moss like... going bonkers in a studio and everyone's standing there just looking at her like, oh my Christ, which is kind of what happens in this film.
Yeah, as Brad Pitt starts to say, and the message he improvises is like, I remember what you playing baseball with, or like you, I became an astronaut.
Yeah,
you'd be proud of what I did. Yeah, I dedicated my life to the exploration of space. I guess that I asked earlier, why is Brad Pitt exploring space? To please his dad, I suppose, but
And it makes us sound like we're dimwits in wanting the film to be explicit. I don't think it's wanting the film to be explicit. I think it's wanting the film to be consistent.
And coherent, I agree, yeah.
You know, you can leave me, you know, some of my favourite films are films that tell me almost nothing. I like films that are silent, but this film is not silent. This film has a lot to say, it just doesn't make very much sense. And Pitt, and this, I think, is the real great flair of the scene, is that Pitt can see that this Wascon people are reacting, and he's like, you've received a message from my father, and they basically say, you're emotionally compromised, we're sending you back to Earth.
Yeah.
And Pitt then talks in... Pitt talks to a Martian whose family was killed by Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah. And also, there was the room in which they're talking has an empty cage and a soft toy monkey on a table next to her. And was that referencing something? Or?
No. It's also worth pointing out, to be more generous to the film than I definitely have been, this feels like a film that was extensively reshot. I mean, we're going to get to something that I 100% know was reshot. But there's, in the trailer, for instance, Donald Sutherland says, the real enemy out there in space is not a thing or a person, it's loneliness or something like that, which is nowhere to be found in the film. So I think there was more Sutherland. I think there's all kinds of stuff that's been taken out. Because, I mean, this is like a contextual stuff, but I think what happened is Gray, who has always been ignored by lots of, you know, he's an underrated director. His films don't make lots of money often. His films are not like very popular at awards season. I think what happened with this one is that people behind the scenes said to him, like, we can make this an Oscar player. We can make this a big film. And so they forced him to make it slightly more acceptable. And I think that's what adds to this incoherence. But yeah, well, I mean, this is the most incoherent thing, I think, is this Martian says to him, so Spacecom have dismissed him. They've said, go home. And yet, let him...
And she's kind of his escort, right? Or she's... I don't even know. She's there.
Spacecom don't seem to care that he's talking to this woman whose parents were part of the Lima Project run by Tommy Lee Jones and were killed by Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah. Oh, something we forgot to mention is that little mulch USB that was given to Brad Pitt by Donald Sutherland, Brad plugs it into a screen when he's on the space shuttle going to Mars and sees video of his dad admitting that he killed a bunch of people because they wanted, like, a bunch of the participants in Project Lima, they wanted to go home, they weren't sufficiently dedicated to the cause, so I shut off their oxygen. He says something, or shut off the wing, and he says something like, some of the innocent were purged with some of the guilty, or something like that. So this freaks Brad Pitt out. And so he's aware that his father has...
Yeah. And this Martian,
maybe lost it.
This Martian tells him, yeah, your dad killed my parents, and smuggles him onto a ship so he can continue with the mission. Which, as I say, why would Spacecom dismiss him? And why would Spacecom dismiss him, send him home, he's emotionally compromised, but just no one follows him, no one checks in on him, he has free access to a woman who they presumably know is on Mars, and they know that she has a history with Brad Pitt's dad. What I was saying, and it's, you know, it's, I think it's a bad thing for a critic to do, and I guess I am a critic first and foremost, is like, you shouldn't talk about the version of the movie that you would have wanted to see, because it doesn't mean anything. Everyone has their own version of the movie. But what I was saying to Brianna is like, why do you need that character at all? Why can't you say something like, the Spacecom say to Brad Pitt, yeah, go and meet your father, and then they fly him towards where his father is, and then the crew on the ship that are flying him turn on him and kill him because Spacecom have decided that he has to be silenced.
Or try to kill him.
Or try, and then he can kill them all, which he does anyway.
Or he realizes they have like a nuclear payload on the ship.
And they're going to blow up
his dad.
Which they
do, and they're going to blow up his dad, and he's like, hey, wait a second, don't do this, and they say, we're ordered.
Yeah.
That would make much more sense.
I don't know why you need this character. I suppose you need the character to tell you that Tommy Lee Jones is dangerous. You already know that's the case from the mulch Sutherland key. And I guess this is part of the problem, is that it's so convoluted when it doesn't seem like it needs to be.
And all its best scenes are extraordinarily sleek.
100%. And simple. And one sentence.
Yeah.
Moon buggy fight on Mars.
Great.
Killer space monkey. That's all I got.
I would watch films called both those things.
Yeah. Snakes on a plane. Exactly. You know? Anyway, I don't even know how much it's worth going over this finale in much detail, because it's so back and forth.
I mean, so the I mean, one of the... this is when I thought the film's silliness was particularly inconsistent, is... And this makes all the circumstances that you just described about Spacecom, you, one, presuming that Spacecom would shut this down, and the fact that they don't do that, more crazy, which is that this woman Brad Pitt meets says, I can smuggle you onto the ship that's going to blow up your father with a nuclear payload. And it's the ship that it's the ship with the crew that Brad Pitt came to Mars on from the moon. So he's familiar with the crew. The way she smuggles him onto the ship, yeah. So they get in a moon buggy. They drive to a manhole on Mars. Yeah. She says there's a lake underneath the launch pad.
Which is true, scientifically true, that ships do that. Because they get incredibly hot.
Like, yeah, which true. I bet they get incredibly hot. not for Brad Pitt. And so there is this, I guess, that I found this beautiful, a sequence of Brad Pitt swimming through blackness through the lake.
Yeah,
so
he
enters the manhole.
Makes me think of You Were Never Really Here.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Just that lake
someone
scene.
In an emotionally compromised position swimming through dark water.
Wonderful. Except Brad Pitt is entirely space-suited, which in some ways makes it less interesting, some ways makes it more interesting. Yeah. And then he emerges onto the launch pad with minutes to go before launch. And I'm no space expert, but I would presume, as you hear the engines warming up, that Brad Pitt would disintegrate within moments.
No.
Or at least it would fry his internal organs, or he would be like wiping his brow at the very least.
Brow.
But he climbs up the internal structure of the shuttle rockets and then
gets in like, with a second to go.
No, but doesn't even get it. It launches when he's in there, and then he, again, Brad Pitt moving levers, which is something that recurs in this film, like makes his way in and like makes his way into the ship through some kind of, you know, portal. And the people on the ship start freaking out. So this crew that he was friends with before saying there's been a breach. And then they radio to Mission Command or whatever. And they say, you know, Roy McBride is on board. And what follows is a kind of confused brawl. Brad Pitt says, he's saying very calmly, I'm not a threat. I'm not here to kill you. I just want to be on board. I think you'll need me to be on board. Raising his arms in the air. But they are not having any of it. Someone points a gun at him. Mayhem ensues and they all die, basically. Like, through various means that sometimes are a little clearer or less clear. A woman, due to gravity switching, plunging towards a door and getting smashed. Brad Pitt making a guy stab himself. Another guy, when oxygen is oxygen deprived and chokes. As Brad Pitt tries to save him, I guess importantly, Brad Pitt, like, puts an oxygen mask on him and says, breathe, breathe. The guy dies. Brad Pitt in a... Actually, a scene that reminded me of... unfavorably to Ad Astra reminded me of High Life, which is another film where a bunch of people on a spaceship die, but is so much more interestingly handled.
Yeah.
And also a scene that actually Ad Astra, High Life opens with the bodies of the dead floating into space, 100%. Which you then kind of work out what led us to that point.
Which is High Life's an interesting comparison point too about this broader point about Ad Astra's incoherence, is that High Life clearly is saying something, but barely says it at all, right? Yeah. Like, what's High Life about? It's about things in the broadest possible terms. It obviously has stuff to say, but it's kind of wormy and like a weird Gnostic text.
It's
like,
it's almost a painting.
Yeah,
High Life, which Ad Astra is a lot of different paintings.
Yeah, and then this is the thing that I alluded that we'd get to. Brad Pitt now is on the ship by himself for 79 days, going to see his father. This is the movie.
Also like High Life.
This is the movie Ad Astra. This is your movie. What the fuck that you skip over this bit of the movie in montage?
Maybe a 2-minute montage. Maybe.
This is your movie. Just start with Brad Pitt on a ship. Everyone's dead. Do a little bit of... But as I'm saying that, I'm like, oh, that's just
basically... We can flash back to the space monkey. It's also basically... It's basically High Life as well.
Yeah.
Which
is...
It's
basically High Life.
But High Life's a better movie than Ad Astra, and Solaris is a better movie than Ad Astra.
I felt cheated by the film that it wants to brush past that.
I thought that was going to be the film. Like, and I guess... I did kind of have an unsteady idea of how far I was into this film during the film. Yeah. I didn't have a good... It's not that it took ages, but it certainly didn't fly
boring.
By. It's not...
I was never bored.
I think that's the other reason I would recommend it, right? Is, despite it really... losing it in the final sequence, the final act, I think it's entertaining. which is not nothing.
I don't know if it would entertain me again. I think I know where it's ending up, and I think it would irritate me.
So Brad Pitt is like flashing back more vigorously in this scene. You get some more of Liv Tyler. You get some more of him and his dad as a child. Brad Pitt as a child. And then he's like, there's this really fascinating moment where he's shaking his head back and forth and repeating a phrase, something like, I don't want to, or
I am alone here. There's some something, reference to alone. That's what I mean about this being the film, right? It feels...
I want to see Brad Pitt go mad.
Yeah,
in it's space the most interesting thing Brad Pitt does. And also, not to skip ahead too much, but has no results. Like, the fact that he goes through 79 days in space...
By himself.
Does not have any noticeable consequence, apart from maybe it being something he overcomes to not be like that anymore. Yeah.
It makes me think a little bit... I think my problem with this thing being brushed over is it makes me think of... I feel another sci-fi, a heralded sci-fi film that I did not like, Arrival.
Quite liked Arrival.
What's Arrival about? Arrival's about communicating with aliens. How do they work out the alien language? In montage.
Sure.
It's your movie. Your movie is about communication. Why are you skipping over what to me is the most interesting bit of that film?
I think it does spend a bit of time on their confusion and then on the fact that they can communicate, which is nice.
They're speaking in full sentences to these aliens.
I
mean,
look... Not to... I do like that film. I understand that criticism. I do not know how I would write learning to understand aliens.
I know. That's 100% true. But it makes me think, too, of... that problem broadly makes me think of Primer. Do you know that film?
I haven't watched that in years. I remember being totally transfixed by it when I watched it.
And I think it's transfixing because Primer has basically no characters. You don't know
anything about those people. It was made for like $8, right?
Yeah. You don't know anything about those people. There's no emotional stakes.
No.
What is the journey of that film? It's working out what the fuck is happening. And it's very complicated and it makes no concessions. I think you could do that with Arrival. And I think you could do a version of that with Ad Astra.
Yeah.
If you're making a film that's about loneliness, this film, to me, doesn't feel particularly lonely.
No.
It has the pacing of a film that's meditative. It doesn't seem to be meditating on much. I suppose that's the thing. What I want it to be is I want it to be a harder viewing experience, like a more boring viewing experience,
sure,
but a more fulfilling film thematically.
Well, I think that is a question, particularly in relation to something like Primer, of generosity to the audience. Because Primer presumes... I mean, I guess you could
say it ignores you.
It ignores you, but it's so... It has so much respect for you.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you'll be able to work this out. Right.
And I ultimately don't care if you do or you don't.
Exactly. Which I think is a form of generosity, to be honest. I think that's kind of like writerly generosity. It's giving you something to engage with, and yet it's not treating you like a moron. And this film does kind of treat you like a moron, which I think is why I don't like the voiceover.
It flip-flops. I think more and more about the voiceover. I struggle with it. But then there's... I don't know if we should get bogged down in this ending because...
Well, I think we have to describe what happens.
But it goes back and fucking... That's what irritates me. Tommy, he's there.
I mean, okay, well, what are the bullet points?
Tommy Lee Jones, he's there. Sorry. He sees the search. Well, Tommy Lee Jones says, hello.
But there's a bunch of important things, right? Like, silly. Important because they're silly. Brad Pitt can't dock with... Brad Pitt spots the ship. There is, a satellite dish that seems to be... I feel like this is too painful for you to walk through. I feel like that's the issue.
I feel like my blood pressure is rising, but it jumps through a lot of hoops.
Satellite dish seems... It's like, okay, there's electricity there. That's what's been sending surges all throughout the galaxy into Earth. Mm-hmm. Whatever, fine. Mm-hmm. Because of that, or for some reason, the ship is damaged. Brad Pitt can't dock with the ship. That's just a narrative block. It's like in a video game where you have to go back through... a passage, but rocks have fallen in your way. That's the entire purpose of the ship not quite working. So Brad Pitt has to float from his ship to Tommy Lee Jones's base. He enters. Tommy Lee Jones says, I have cataracts. Is that you, son? It is. He says, I've never cared about you.
Lee Jones says to
Pitt. Yeah, Lee Jones says to Pitt, I never cared about you or your mother. I just went to space. I wanted to find aliens, and I dedicated my life to this. I still haven't found them. So this is said in kind of an interesting positioning where Brad Pitt... Like, Tommy Lee Jones is above a floor that is a grated metallic floor, so you have this kind of distance between them. Pitt floats up to greet his father, who looks very old and unwell, mentally and physically. And, yeah, I guess you're right.
He crucially says that people were trying to escape, and that's what caused the surge.
That's right. Which, well...
What is the Surge?
Yeah, and also not only what is the Surge, I guess it's crucial to find that out about his character. But again, you could have had the opposite, like, I caused the Surge intentionally, and it wouldn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter for any reason.
I suppose it's lunging towards complexity with the father. The film doesn't want to be like... The film broadly is... You're expecting Tommy Lee Jones to be Colonel Kurtz, right? In Apocalypse Now. You're expecting him to be completely... Like, raving. Just saying these things that don't make any sense. He is still trying to do good.
He wants to find aliens.
Yeah. And then there's this jumble of... I don't even know
how... Well, Pitt tries to bring him back to the ship. He says, let's go back to Earth. Yeah. Jones resists very tender, like, very kind of limply.
And that's kind of beautiful. That was when I thought, like, maybe this film will win me over. Because Pitt is trying to touch Jones and Jones is pulling back. And they're both extraordinary performers, Jones and Pitt. Sure. And it's an extraordinary... It really did, like, I felt pricks in my eyes at, like, the dad withdrawing and...
They have chemistry.
...taking his son's hand. And they need chemistry, right? Because it's a film about them and they have about 5 minutes of shared screen time.
Yeah, you believe that they are son and father.
Yeah, even though they look nothing alike.
They don't look anything alike.
And then Pitt tries to get his dad back on and hooks him on, and then Jones flies backwards with an air propulsion thing to try and kill them both.
Yeah.
But then after trying to kill them both, or maybe just stop them from going, Jones says to Pitt, like, you have to let me go. So what is the idea that he's having, like, glimpses of sanity again? Why is he suddenly saying that after... He could have just unhooked himself from his son.
Yeah.
Why is he pulling him back and then almost immediately going, like, you have to let me go?
I don't know. Firstly, if you can hear one of us swallowing or licking our nose, it's actually the dog. Ida, if that's being picked up on the microphone. She's been very good this whole time.
She's been such a good girl.
Yeah, she's doing well. So, yeah, I didn't understand the motivation of that scene. Brad Pitt is... This is the time at which you see him at his most emotional and distraught. And that is interesting, I think. So you have this utter terror at letting go of his father. It's extraordinary. It's very moving. It's very effective in the basics of it. This man does not want to let go of his father. It works beyond its function as a metaphor, which I think is good.
Yeah.
But... there's also quite a beautiful shot where they're struggling in space together in their spacesuits. Brad Pitt is trying to keep Tommy Lee Jones to him. And there's this very wide shot in which you just see them tumbling around one another in space.
Yeah.
Until Tommy Lee Jones eventually...
flies off.
Flies into Neptune.
Yeah. And this is the thing that... because I think it's also worth pointing out, which I haven't seen discussed a lot. This film is also exactly Interstellar.
I haven't seen Interstellar.
Okay, Interstellar is like, the planet is dying. It's dying because of dust storms. We have to find a new planet for Earth. And it's about Matthew McConaughey abandoning his kids to go to space. And then there's time warps. So it's basically the story of Ad Astra from the point of view of the father, whereas this is from the point of view of the son. And Interstellar, in its final 20 minutes, goes loopy, goes silly, exactly like this film.
What is it about space movies?
Space Odyssey, right?
It does it well, but...
yeah,
gotta go nuts.
Absolutely. Or just, like, I just don't... you know, this film wants you to believe that it's doing a gravity, right? Like, the film Gravity. It's being incredibly thoughtful about space.
It's a philosophy of... person and space.
But
like,
then what happens is Brad Pitt pulls a bit of
Brad Pitt's father is gone. Brad Pitt has to get back to his ship because it couldn't dock, right? So in order to do this, Brad Pitt unhooks a metal panel from some kind of satellite or antenna on Tommy Lee Jones's ship. And the thing about Neptune, it has rings. If Brad Pitt were to simply float through those rings, he would be obliterated despite his steeliness. It would not be enough to protect him. And he... it feels like something from an anime. Joe looks so grim about this. This is a real turn off for the film, I think. This is when its silliness, this is when its self-seriousness makes it impossible to enjoy.
It also makes it impossible, as I've said throughout, and I do feel guilty and sad. It sucks when you feel like you're sitting in the corner, like, poking holes in everyone's fun, particularly over things that in other contexts I would say don't matter, but, like, this film wants you to take it deathly seriously, and also contains a scene where somehow with the help of a metal door,
yeah.
Brad Pitt travels through the rings.
He traverses the rings with the rocks. The thing is, though, he's holding it.
And it sparks briefly. I thought, like, Pitt is going to die now.
For a lot of it... Oh, we didn't mention as well that Brad Pitt planted the nuclear warhead on...
The Lima Project space station.
Yeah. So he's obvious... And then it's like a 3-hour countdown.
Yeah.
So there's some vague sense of time sensitivity, but not really.
Does it take 3 hours to get through a ring? I don't know. If you've just kicked off?
Yeah, it's true. I guess he's got to, like, warm his ship up again. But, yeah, it's like, the way he's holding the shield is as if one... He's got his hands wrapped around the side. So his fingers are exposed. That's important.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have a handle on the back, which means that he has to count on his fingers not getting destroyed by all these rocks. I mean, not to go too much into the minutiae of it,
but it
doesn't fit with the fairly... It's a tonal problem.
And also...
And it's just very funny to watch Brad Pitt launching through this ring. Like, again, like an anime character.
I think even if you've been more generous, perhaps, than I have been to this film throughout, then that's the scene that... You have to account for.
Because it also doesn't need to be in the film.
No.
You just let him dock on the ship.
Yeah.
And let him just get back into his spaceship and fly back.
I mean...
Or let him die.
We're to talk about it because we're almost at the end. But basically what the film wants to say is from that point, he gets back to Earth. He lands on Earth. Again, montage. No sense that any of this has been difficult whatsoever. It blinks by. He's got a slight beard when he lands on Earth.
Yeah. There's a kind of very... A scene that could be in a US Army recruitment video in which they open the door of his shuttle that has crashed onto Earth and someone, like a man, kind of puts his hand in through the door for Brad Pitt to grasp and to pull him out. And he's kind of heroically pulled out. And I think there's a voiceover. I mean, we haven't talked excessively about the voiceover, partially because it's just hard to track when it happens when you're not watching the film. But I feel like there's maybe 10 or 15 instances of it throughout the movie, which is too many.
It's always quite short. I don't know. See, I'm weirdly positive on the voiceover.
I don't think it was ever necessary.
I think I like sometimes cinematic literalism. I like to be pointed at something and told, this is the thing that you're looking at.
The metaphors are so laboured in this film already.
I probably sound like the world's worst film watcher, being like, I need the film to explain to me how he can get through the rings, and also I need it to be literal. I need a voice at all times to say...
In this Space Dad movie.
Yeah.
Where Tommy Lee Jones is destroying Earth through, like, it's electricity, whatever. Like, it's just, he's going to destroy Earth. I mean, it doesn't... Like, but those things are fine, right? It's like, okay, we have the MacGuffin, we have that.
Yeah.
I'm totally on board with that.
It is a MacGuffin.
But, it's hard. And then a scene we didn't mention that is right at the beginning of the film is one in which Brad Pitt is sitting by himself and giving an account of his well-being to the psychology robot. And he's saying things like, you know, I'm calm, I slept, I didn't have any bad dreams. And then... After he's rescued from the spaceship, after he lands back on Earth, which again is this... Like, you presume he's had to go through another 79 days of madness, which we brush over entirely.
100%.
After he's watched his father die in space,
yeah.
Which seems significant, but is not handled.
Well, his dad... to be fair to the film wants the emotional pivot point of his entire journey is his father saying, let me go. Which, as we mentioned, is an extremely ham-fisted metaphor. But it is a very trackable metaphor. It's not incoherent at all. It's like... You know, your dad caused you pain. Acknowledge that he caused you pain, and stop obsessing. Stop trying to be him. Sure. Leave him behind.
Space therapy. And I think I'm fine with that.
It's certainly true that the film expects you to accept the fact that that is all he needed. That's the single lesson he needed to heal completely. Because the film, as you say, we get the narration from the beginning, or the speech to the therapy bot repeated.
So that's repeated right at the end of the film.
And then in...
Brad Pitt says he might literally say, I am capable of love, or I've learned to love again, or something like that. I'm not going to say I quite like this film. I think this is a fine film. I think it's weird enough that I think it's worth seeing. But I do feel like I've come across in this podcast as really hating on it, which obviously... You're very convincing.
I think you're about to... We just seconds before... Yeah,
the worst moment in the film.
Which is the second to last shot in the film. And I saw a critic Maybe I didn't see it, because I was thinking in retrospect, no one could have said that. I think I saw someone say the last shot of this movie is an all-timer. The last shot of this film is Liv Tyler. He's in some kind of restaurant. He sees Liv Tyler, and it cuts back to his face, and he kind of smiles, and then it cuts to black.
So again, is that really the last shot? I knew that. I thought that was the last scene, but that's crazy.
I think
because this is a character who we have had no work done on. She is entirely a vehicle for Brad Pitt's emotions.
She means nothing. Why do we want him to be with her?
Why does she want to be with him? Yeah. Also, like, we haven't even, like, as much as Brad Pitt does a lot of work to convey a fair amount of internal turmoil in this film, you have no sense of him as the kind of person that someone would want to be in a relationship with.
What does the relationship look? And again, this sounds like we're begging for literalism. I don't think that's what it is. I think the film wants you to feel such joy and happiness that Liv Tyler and Brad Pitt are back together again. And I feel nothing because I have no idea who these people are. I have no idea what their relationship looks like. I have no idea what their future looks like. It's meant to be a moment of pure, teary catharsis for the audience.
Yeah.
And it uses Liv Tyler as an extremely lazy tool, to the point to which I genuinely think that if someone is trying to sing you the praises of this film, which of course they can, of course, but if someone's trying to do that without trying to in some way explain or tackle Liv Tyler and Liv Tyler's arc, I think there's... Deception sounds fucked up. I don't think there's deception. I think you owe it to somebody to explain that this film is somehow good in despite of the way that Liv Tyler is used.
Yeah.
Because she's used like a supporting character in a film from the 60s.
Yeah.
She's
blank. She's a blank slate.
She's completely blank. And,
Roll credits.
Roll credits. And of course, I can, you know, I do feel this, like, deep wellspring of frustration about this film. But, you know, I suppose, you know, there's this story. Maybe this is, like, serves as, like, a little colon.
Go for it.
There's this story about John Krasinski was having dinner with Paul Thomas Anderson.
Okay.
As you do. Sure. As I'm sure happens in Hollywood LA. All the time. Exactly.
La La Land.
And Krasinski was being dismissive of a film, an original property that he thought was just completely up its own butt. And PTA, like, quite seriously, from Krasinski's telling, it sounds like PTA was like, put social niceties aside and was like, you can't be rude about those films. You have to be happy that Hollywood is making them, even if they don't work.
And
if that's why I'm positive at Ad Astra, because I'm well aware...
It's not a sequel. It's an original property.
It's an original property that does...
Ad Astra 2.
Dad Returns.
Tommy Lee Jones in like a Iron Man suit.
Yes.
He went on the ground in Neptune.
And he teamed up with the monkeys. Yeah, the baboons.
That would be. He's got an army. He returns to Earth with an army of space monkeys. Damn, I would watch that.
We just made $100 million.
It's a good pitch.
Yeah. You know, I'm excited that it exists. I am genuinely, and I'm excited because it's a Pitt star vehicle, and I'm obsessed with Brad Pitt.
I mean, but is this a film that leads to more Pitt star vehicles? I mean, what does this make at the box office?
What does this make at the box office is a fascinating question. But I mean, sometimes stuff is surprising, right? Like, The Shape of Water
is
made a lot of money. Like, a lot of money. And that looks bizarre. But,
I guess I'll put this on tape. I don't see this as being... Certainly not a mega hit.
I certainly do
see it. I see it as winning, like, a special effects Oscar.
I don't know. I think it has the critical propulsion to make it through as a Best Picture nominee. And that's why I mentioned The Shape of Water. I think sometimes if you're locked in as a Best Picture nominee, people go and see it. Because there are people who just see everything. So I think I don't necessarily see this movie losing money. But it's worth pointing out the audience that we saw it with... I didn't necessarily see a sense of propulsion as people left the theatre.
No.
I didn't necessarily feel... I certainly didn't feel like that when I left the cinema for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That, I saw it with a packed house that seemed frustrated.
Confused.
By the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that film's made a lot of money. So I'm... Despite the problems I have with it, I'm really not wishing for this to be a commercial failure. I really am... We need movies like this. Because I'm so fucking sick of superhero movies.
Yeah. I think this is also... There is enough in this to make it... Again, I think there's enough in this to make it weird and worthwhile. It's not just an original property that's replaying a bunch of stuff. There are genuinely beautiful scenes. There are genuinely weird decisions.
I guess just the thing that I react to worst as a viewer And it's why I spend my life watching fucking Chopping Mall, is I hate the sense of being spoken down to, and I hate the sense of being condescended to. And I do sense condescension in this film.
That's interesting. I don't actually... I read it as... maybe pretentious.
I feel like
I don't think it's condescending.
It thinks that it can get stuff past me. I feel like it thinks that it can just slip Donald Sutherland being 900 years old past me, and Liv Tyler being not a character past me, and I will be so caught up in its magnificence that I won't... that I can be tricked.
See, I think that I would... and again, I'm personifying a film, but I think it... it's too caught up in its own magnificence.
That's true.
I think I'm very sensitive to being... I often worry that movies are being cruel to me. And I don't think this one is. I think it is... it has a sense of grandiosity that it tries to welcome the audience into. But I think it's... it tries to be an empathetic film. I think it's an incoherent film. And I think that's its problem. I don't find it mean... Or patronising. Maybe there are elements of it being patronising.
Maybe you're right. And it's worth saying, I am deeply frustrated, but I'm only frustrated because I see the potential there. It's the shitty thing that your parents say to you, where it's like, you've disappointed
me. Yeah, it's true. That's a big part of the intensity of its failure.
You know, the other night I watched Resident Evil Apocalypse.
Bet you did.
and that's about as... That's a worse film than Ad Astra. I did have to see the light there. I almost said something stupid. That's a worse film than Ad Astra, but I'm not angry with Resident Evil.
Well, how much of it is it about expectations?
I'm sure that's true. But I also think Resident Evil Apocalypse. Here we go. Labored metaphor time. Resident Evil Apocalypse is a really cheap fish and chips from like a pub, and sometimes what you really want is a cheap fish and chips from the pub. What Ad Astra is like, you go to a bespoke restaurant, we're going to present you with a deconstructed fish and chips, and it's like a fucking potato and a still alive fish, right?
Sure.
It's trying to pretend that it's so much.
It's nice to look at, perhaps. Little. Yeah.
Although I don't know if a potato on a plate is nice to look at.
That could be true. Maybe it's like filleted in an interesting way. Can you fillet a potato? Doesn't matter. Know.
But yeah, I do think true. And if I'm tired of superhero movies, I'm tired of superhero movies because I don't think there are enough personal stories being told.
Sure.
And sometimes I wonder. I've been thinking like, this film is obviously a therapy project. It's obviously
session on the couch. It's about catharsis.
And how can you get more personal than that? For Pitt, who knows? I don't know how personally connected Pitt feels to all this.
Well, this is interesting, right? And it's a Plan B film. It's his production company. Yeah. He's obviously involved at a pretty high level.
Yeah.
And he's not making many movies like this these days.
And it's also worth noting, we didn't mention it, Pitt forced Gray to add that ending on. Pitt forced Gray. Well, not forced. Who knows?
Coerced, suggested. It's a hell of a way to start our Brad Pitt podcast, to point to the worst part of a film that has disappointed us as the responsibility of
Mr.
Brad Pitt.
What is this podcast but an attempt to be like, what does Brad Pitt want?
Yeah.
Which is because, as you say, he's chilled in interviews. I would also say he's quite blank in interviews. We've had lots. It's been a great year for really exciting Brad Pitt profiles, but...
who is Brad Pitt?
I have no idea.
Well, I think over the next however many years or podcast episodes...
how many films? We didn't even check.
I think I actually think there's like 30 to 40. If we're doing ones where he's kind of credited or highly billed... I think we could have this out
within a nifty year,
the 2019-2020 season of the Brad Pitt cast. I guess on that note,
do we want to give the film a rating? I know that's so reductive.
I worry about ratings. Maybe we can on like a well, what would your rating be?
I have a letterbox that I compulsively update, and after much thought, I gave Ad Astra 2.5 stars.
So look, I might revise this because this is on the fly, and I art's not for evaluating with numbers.
But fun.
I'd say 3.5.
Okay.
Yeah, and this, I mean, it will give us a sense of the trajectory of Brad Pitt's career if we build up these star ratings.
Because it's
when we've been talking about these films, we've noted, I think it's certainly true that we will run into considerably worse films than this.
Oh, I would hope, I would imagine so.
Like, wait, yeah. Have you seen War Machine?
No.
Okay, well, okay. Dan, 2020 Dan is in for an interesting but a time.
Wonderful. Well, stick with us.
Yeah. Next week, we'll be doing whatever the fuck that sun safety movie is.
Yeah, movie that I think, according to its Wikipedia page, Brad Pitt was paid like $1,800 to star in and seems to include a lot of Eastern Europeans.
Did you see... This is a nice note to end on, but did you see that Wikipedia summary of the film says, like, it was shelved due to lack of entertainment value? What a horrible reason to have your film shelved.
Yeah, may we never make a work of art. May this podcast never be shelved for lack of entertainment value.
Shelved for lots of other reasons.
Well, for those who made it this far, thank you so much for listening.
Yeah, thank you.
And we will be back in Ad Astra, the near future.
The near future.
With more. So until next time.
Until next time.